I'd like to share the opening, the following words by Bets Wennicke. As we gather together this morning, may we learn to recognize and affirm the pieces of possibility, the bits of good we bring. May we encourage rather than control, love rather than possess, enable rather than envy, allowing our individual gifts to weave a patchwork of peace, the soft, deep blue of sensitivity and understanding, the red energy of creativity, the white heat of convictions, the risky, fragile green of new growth, the golden flashes of gratitude, the warm rose of love. Each of us is indispensable if we are to minister to a broken and wounded world. Together, in our gathered diversity, we form the whole. So be it. Please take a moment now to settle into a comfortable position in your chair and this space. I'll read a meditation written by Christine C. Robinson, which we will follow with 1 minute of silence. I invite you into a space of quiet and peace to ground yourself by noticing your contact with chair and floor, by sitting straight, by becoming aware of your breathing. Look at your hands. They've been through a lot. Those hands, they have strengths, scars, beauty. I invite you to remember that it is your hands that do the work of love in the world. These hands may hold another's hands. These hands may type emails to politicians, sign cards of consolation and congratulation. These hands may patiently teach, quilt works of beauty, or write words urging peace. These hands may bathe children, feed elders, nurse the ill, work the earth, organize communities. These hands clasp in prayer, open in release, grasp in solidarity, clench in righteous anger. These hands are God's hands, your hands, our hands, a great mystery of flesh and intention, a great potential of embodied love.
For years, my wife and I have responded to mailed requests from charities. More letters keep coming. Pictures of hungry children and stories of hardship pluck at our heartstrings. For a while, I was supporting 19 environmental groups. We had lots of return address labels. How many forests were being destroyed to supply all this paper? How much was actually helping? I was on a board of one well-known charity. The national organization had a fundraising drive by a professional fundraiser using the telephone. We were required to go along. Money was raised. The professional fundraiser kept 87% of the donations. We got 13%. Our administrative costs came out of that 13%. Now, what was the name of the professional fundraiser? Well, that was a secret. Had a police check been made? No response. Now, if you wish to teach Sunday school, you need a police check. I'm no longer on the board of this charity. In the sociology department at the university, I was the chair of the United Way committee. The United Way uses about 11% of its funds to administer the redistribution. Would it not be better, my colleagues suggested, to contribute directly to a charity of one's choice? Well, I argued that some small charities had difficulty raising funds. They were dependent on the United Way. I wasn't very convincing. Besides, two Red Cross funds received the largest contributions from the United Way. Why? The Red Cross agreed not to raise money while the United Way was campaigning. But I argued the Red Cross did not reveal the salaries paid to their executives. Should the finances of charities who received United Way funds be open? I wrote an article, Why Mother Teresa Was Wrong. And I have copies out on the table out in the hallway. She argued that she did not ask why women were poor. She simply helped them. As a sociologist, I want to know why women are poor. I want to know how we can change conditions so that women do not remain poor. In the same article, I pointed out that the head of the United Way in the United States was criticized for his high salary. Others were annoyed that he was paying his 17-year-old mistress $80,000 for a job when she lacked the appropriate qualifications. Now, in Canada, of course, we're a separate organization. We wouldn't be involved in anything like that. Now, some people feel that wealthy nations should donate 7/10 of their national income to foreign aid. A few Scandinavian countries meet this goal. Canada and the United States do not. I attended a conference recently of an organization committed to reducing poverty. It lobbies Washington and Ottawa to raise the national commitment to 0.7%. It seems like a worthwhile task. But what if those foreign aids go to dictators in African countries? How much money ends up in Swiss bank accounts? How much is used to equip the military so that the dictators can remain in power? Asking that we increase our foreign aid seems to make sense. But should we be looking critically at the consequences? Dambisa Moyo, in her book Dead Aid, argues that foreign aid given to Africa has held them back and has not really helped people. Now, others disagree. But should we be asking the question? Now, organizations that are united behind a common theme and sort of the thinking is everybody shares it. If you have such an organization, you can inspire speakers to generate even more enthusiasm. Skeptics slow down the bandwagon. But is the bandwagon going in the right direction? Should we be asking questions instead of leaping on bandwagons? Imagine a wealthy rock star who wishes to help. One area in Africa needs mosquito netting. The rock star purchases $1 million worth of mosquito netting, made in China, of course, and ships it to Africa. A local manufacturer of mosquito netting is driven out of business. He hired 10 employees, and they fed 50 relatives. Now the employees are out of a job, and the 50 relatives are hungry. 5 years later, the donated mosquito netting has holes. But those who made mosquito netting in that part of Africa are no longer in business. In another country, a church group provided funds to a group of women to cook a pastry that could be sold for lunches to local businesses. The funds from the sales could expand the business. But some of the women did not turn in the money that they received. They could not buy more materials for making more pastry. They were scolded for stealing the money, but the women knew that nothing would be done. The church continued to provide the money for a failing business. A new manager took over and encouraged the women to make better pastries and expand the business. Those who continued to steal were fired and replaced. The business expanded and now supports more women in a growing, successful endeavor. Charitable concerns often concern social activism. Many of us have interests that put us on email lists. Thus, we get requests to take action, write to your member of parliament, do something. Are these recommendations all equally well thought out? Are some of these bandwagons going in the wrong direction? One recent plea was against genetically modified food. Now, I've made a modest effort to understand this issue. There are at least two issues. The corporate control of genetically modified seeds and the financial impact on farmers. That's a political issue. The genetic modification itself is a different issue. Now, some of my acquaintances are scholars who do research in this area. I learned that most of the people opposed to all genetically modified food are woefully misinformed. They're not familiar with things like quantitative trait loci, marker-assisted selection, or genomic editing, which imitates mutations. Now, it's fine for wealthy, well-fed people to be prissy about eating food with genetically modified ingredients. But should they be allowed to slow the development of drought-resistant crops that would feed starving children in Africa? Now, I don't have an answer to this issue, but are poorly informed, enthusiastic activists doing more harm than good? My point, of course, is not the specific issue. Rather, I'm concerned that those with charitable inclinations may be more likely to jump on bandwagons without a serious analysis of the outcome. Are do-gooders more likely to ignore facts? At a recent sociology conference in Japan, I attended some of the sessions of a new section called The Sociology of Disasters. With the earthquake in Nepal, we can anticipate responses similar to those that took place after the disasters in Indonesia, Haiti, or Japan. Highly publicized disasters raise a good deal of money. Regrettably, much of it is wasted. High-heeled shoes donated to Indonesia by one shoe manufacturer resulted in a large tax write-off for the shoe company, but they were of little use to the Indonesians. In Haiti, a group of English-speaking church members went to Haiti and rescued a group of French-speaking children whom they assumed had been orphaned by the earthquake. They were stopped while attempting to take these children out of the country. Most of the children were not orphans. The French-speaking parents of these children wondered who had kidnapped their children. A Canadian province offered to construct buildings in Haiti. What kind? Office buildings. Now, at this conference in Japan, I asked some of these disaster researchers, are there any guidelines that we could follow? Well, the research in this field is new. We don't know very much. But some of these researchers were willing to offer some hunches. Well-known international organizations, like the Red Cross, can put full-page ads in the newspapers and raise a lot of money. But do we have, or do they have, knowledgeable people who speak the local language where the disaster took place? Do they know who is corrupt? And do they actually understand what needs to be done? Do you want to give money to an organization that will not make public the salaries they offer to their executives? The Royal Bank of Canada has offered to handle donations. But the Royal Bank also helps hundreds of large corporations launder their money in other countries to avoid paying taxes. As do the Toronto Dominion and Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. The Royal Bank and several other Canadian banks helped Enron cheat their customers. Only the Canadian Imperial Bank of Canada, only the Imperial Bank of Commerce, was taken to court in the U.S., not in Canada. If you wish to help people in disaster areas, do you trust such organizations with your donations, especially when you realize that most of that money is wasted? Now, some disaster researchers noted that international organizations have political clout, but do they have experienced local staff in the countries where the disasters took place? Smaller local organizations, staffed primarily with local women, may understand the situation better than these large organizations, and they may be more effective. Now, some charities are better investments than others. In developing countries, it seems that educating young females rather than males yields a better return for society. Educated girls give birth at a later age, and they have fewer and healthier children. What happens when a problem comes up that we had not anticipated? In one country, when a girl begins to menstruate, she may be embarrassed and drop out of school. What do you do? You want to keep these girls in school. A class on hygiene and the availability of sanitary napkins increased the likelihood that these girls would stay in school. We need the local wisdom quite often to know what's going on in the area. We don't always make very good decisions from a few thousand miles away. Now, usually, working with a charity makes us feel good. But should we be cautious about what makes us feel good? I spoke with a woman in a shelter for battered women. She was a professional woman. But to protect herself and her child, she needed the women's shelter. She was happy to have a local church provide a free meal. But she could also cook, as could many of the other women in the shelter. She would have been happy to help prepare the meal with the church women. But to make these visitors feel good, she needed to play the role of a battered woman in need of its free meal. distinguish between compassion and actual accomplishment. Some charities may be able to overcome obstacles, but others may fail. They may be overwhelmed by things they cannot control. Is there a time for a funding organization to say, "I'm sorry, the corruption in your government and the violence in your society is simply too much. It is time for us to pull the plug. Your project didn't work," and devote our limited resources to those groups which have more promise? Now, this would be a very difficult choice to make. Compassion often trumps factual information. Now, some recipients of donations think that donors have lots of money. They don't realize that ordinary single-income families sometimes save money and accumulate enough that could make a difference if used wisely. Providing money to charities that fail means less for those who are accomplishing something. Now, I don't want to leave you all depressed or overly cautious. This church, or assembly, or whatever it is we want to call ourselves, has some great traditions for helping. These are very satisfying activities, but it takes work and arguments and the careful weighing of information. Doing the job well is much more rewarding than just doing it because we feel we have an obligation. I'd like to dedicate this talk to Bob Dobbs. Bob Dobbs did not jump on bandwagons easily.
In the words of Judy Wells, "Let us go out now into the sun-washed light of the blossoming world. May the inner light of our own being add its bright blessing to the dappled days and enhance the glow of nightfall."